Welcome to the Design Vertec podcast. This podcast is all about promoting design, usability, and experience in Pakistan. Don't forget to check out the behind-the-scenes outtakes at the end of the show. My name is Imran Hussain. I'm Vice President of Design and User Experience at Systems Limited. And today, my co-host is Dr. Suleiman Shahid, who's an assistant professor at LUMS. And our guest today is Ahmed Riaz, all the way from California, Logitech, right? And so welcome to the show, Ahmed.
Well, thanks for having me here.
Yeah. So what do you do at Logitech?
At Logitech, I'm the head of design strategy. Mm-hmm. And so that's just a fancy way of saying that I look at projects that really look into new kinds of products for Logitech. And so Logitech does a lot of different types of products, and some of them are very evolutionary, so we're just looking at the next version of something. And then some of them are transformative, and so my team looks at transformative products and really kind of thinks about ways of like looking at completely new opportunity areas and then developing concepts within those opportunity areas.
Okay, so that's a fancy word, transformative. Products, you know.
Yeah, yeah. We can throw in innovative in there and other, you know,
sellable,
strategy.
Sellable.
Yes, yeah, sellable. Yeah. Yeah.
And so, tell us something. Some of the transformative products that you've come up with so recently.
I've only been at Logitech a year and a half, but I can talk about.
Just to give us a sense of what transformative means. You
know? So for us, what transformative means products that are. Really kind of looking at completely new types of categories, right?
Okay, because so Logitech is like known for, you know, when I hear the word Logitech, the thing that comes to my mind is like mice and keyboards and cameras.
So I think that's very true. And when I first sort of was introduced to Logitech and people were asking me to work there, it's like, oh yeah, mice and keyboards and cameras, right? Why would I do that? And what was really interesting is by going inside and really understanding the way that they were structured, I think that we think of ourselves really as productivity tools, right? And so how do you make work feel amazing and fun and interesting? So one example of a transformative tool within productivity is our Spotlight presenter, which is which as you hold it is like a confidence building object. And then you can sort of like rethink of the way a laser pointer works with the way that the spotlight actions.
So can you briefly like describe what it does? I mean, because the normal presents a red dot. Okay, that you can kind of point and, you know, wiggle around on the screen. So what does this spotlight thing do?
So what the spotlight thing does is that instead of like a little dot that you, like you said, you wiggle around and get people's attention. It's really small, but you know, it's kind of like the future of lasers. What the spotlight does is it actually creates a really nice halo and puts a spotlight by darkening everything else, right? When you're looking at the screen, it's sort of like
so it helps people focus on a specific thing.
It does the same thing that the laser thing does, but it does it in a way that feels very different. It feels like you're on stage, and then there's an actual spotlight, and then you know your eye is driven to that object, right? It's more sort of stage performance. And I think that's sort of a really good example of like how we think of productivity. And so similarly, we're doing things within our other categories, which are gaming. Right. So again, and within gaming, you have keyboards and mice, but we're looking at ways of doing something completely different. So a really transformative product within gaming is we found that having cables and all this stuff was really annoying. But gamers felt like they really needed it because they couldn't lose any performance. And no, they never wanted to have a mouse that ran out of batteries. So we created a mouse that through the way our technology works, there's absolutely not only no lag, it's actually faster than cables. And we've created a mouse pad that is always charging your mouse. So your mouse is actually never running out of battery.
Oh, so that's, is that what we call inductive charging?
So it does inductive charging while you're using the mouse on the pad.
And not
so,
like the Apple mouse, you have to insert a cable at the back of it to the bottom to be able to charge.
Quite you can if you like, but you don't have to.
You don't have to.
In theory, it's a mouse that will never run out of battery as you're using it. And so that's a way that we change the way that people are thinking about gaming and really getting into esports.
Yeah.
So similarly, and I won't go into like each one's like example, but we do music products, we do security products, which is where maybe some of the camera stuff comes in. We sort of think of ourselves within these different types of verticals, and we have a number of others as well. So I think that's kind of the way that we think of ourselves. I think the mice, the keyboards, the controllers, the input devices, all that stuff is really a way for us to connect to people to technology. And traditionally, that's been connecting people to computers. But we know that people connect to technology in many different ways. And so now we really think of ourselves as, how do we connect people through objects to technology in the cloud? And that's sort of an evolution that we're going through as a company.
Hmm. Because I think, so you mentioned gaming, and gaming is an area where I think there's a lot of opportunity to, you know, to connect people and their devices together. And the other one, productivity. So I can't recall any meeting where it was not a big pain in trying to connect to the projector and kind of do a good presentation using some appropriate tools. So, and here we are in 2018, and we still people have issues with these basic things. So I think there's a lot of room for innovation and transformation.
One of the things I wanted to ask is that, what is the difference between, you know, working for a design consultancy like Frog Design and then working for a product company like Logitech? I think they're two different, the way you work, the way you look at the problem, the way the business needs are, must be different. Would you reflect on that?
So before I joined Logitech, I was at Frog Design and I was there for about 7 years. So so I lived the consultancy life
for
a very long time. I think they're quite different. I think the thing that's really different is when you're in consulting world, you're sort of, you're hired gun, right? You come in, you do what you need to do, and you have a lot of control over the culture of how you do it, right? Because you take all that work and you do it in your studio. And studio culture is a very important thing for consulting. I think for a lot of things. And you protect that. But then ultimately, when you do the final readout or you share the final designs, you sort of walk away, you know, explosions in the background. It doesn't matter what's going to happen. And you're on to your next thing. And one of the reasons I moved away from consulting, even though I'd been doing it for a long time, part of it was just for personal family reasons, just to get more time with my kids, right?
It was being more a traveling consultant. It was more occupied, your consultancy life.
I would travel for that. And I wanted to not travel having small kids as much.
Those are the demands of the job, you know?
I had a go bag and I would just be able to go at any point, right? And as I rose among the ranks, that became more and more of a requirement, right? Like, you just traveled a lot. And then the other side of it was just that I found that a lot of the things I worked on never saw light of day. And part of the nature of that is working on things that have these ambiguous terms and names, and not there's a very low success rate.
Yeah.
But I felt like it had to be higher when you went in-house and you actually could shepherd things through. Mm. And one of the big reasons I actually moved was I worked on a project in Pakistan with Telenor, and it was really structured differently for Frog. We worked with them for 3 years. We don't really do that. We usually come in for about 2 month engagements.
Okay.
So a 3 year project was like, required a lot of patience. Some of the people that started me on that project were like gone by the time I was done. And they were like, why do you stick with this thing? And I was like, it is the most satisfying thing I've done.
Yeah.
Not only because I got to work in Pakistan and work with Pakistanis really for the first time in my professional career, but because it showed me what it takes to make something new real and have that kind of level of patience. And there were a number of other things that became real, but we were not always involved for as long. And so I was really craving that kind of seeing things through bit of it. So what I'm really trying to do within Logitech is sort of combine the consulting sort of model in some ways in terms of like thinking about big elaborate ideas and bringing in some of that studio culture. Nice. But then also taking the responsibility of sticking with things and saying, we're not going to walk away. If we break things and tear things apart, we'll be here to put them back together again. And really taking that sort of next step, I think, is really critical. And I think culturally, Logitech's a great company, and they have really good work-life balance.
That's nice.
And I think they have a really interesting domain as well. And there's
diverse
room,
also.
There's room to grow and there's room for things to happen. And then finally, the thing that attracted me to the sort of that idea, and it's sort of also a frog thing, is it's a combination of physical and digital. And so I was trained as an industrial designer, but never really practiced as an industrial designer. I've always wanted to kind of be around that
the products,
sort of culture.
Tangible things.
About that tangible thing. I lust for that. I think a lot of what I do as a user experience designer is actually rooted in that industrial design education. Yeah. And so for me, combining all that stuff together and working on things that are physical and digital is hugely rewarding. Right.
So this is a good point to kind of delve into your past. And so tell us a bit about your education in design.
Sure.
And how did you get to that point where you decided that you wanted to make a career in design or at least educate yourself?
You,
and then
you
from that
design?
Point onwards, where did you go and how?
Yeah, so...
From the beginning.
From the beginning. So, I mean,
like
most...
Date of birth, city of birth.
Exactly. Yeah. Skip the social security number.
I was born in Lahore, in Lady Wellington Hospital. And 2 months later, I left the country. But I was, much like many brown parents, I was given a choice of becoming a doctor or engineer.
Good.
Which is a very typical thing, I think.
Story all over the world, all immigrants.
And I chose engineering.
What type?
Computer engineering.
Okay.
The hardest type.
Nice.
I think.
Good to know.
And then I tried to do computer engineering for about a year and a half in the US. And I wasn't very happy and I wasn't doing very well. And I was flying back to the Middle East where my family lived, and I knew I had to do something different. And so I picked up these magazines, you know, like just to read on the plane. And I was always attracted to like creativity and art, and I, even with computer engineering, I was like, I'll do computer engineering, but I'll do something creative with it. That was kind of the idea, right? And I was taking a lot of art classes as well while I was in school for some reason, just to kind of balance things out. But the magazines I had picked on my flight back were the design issue of Wired, was one of them. I remember it very clearly. You could put your hand on it. It would take a print of your hand. And it was sort of like this idea of like ergonomics was inside it.
Uh-huh.
And I remember just flipping through it and just like my mind just blew. It was like, people get paid to do this? It's like a job? Who's paying people? You know? And I was flipping through it and then there was like...
And so you just basically your mind just flipped.
Well, my mind flipped. They're like, whoa, this is like a job.
Uh-huh.
No one told me this was a job. And then there was this guy called Kareem Rashid. I don't know if you know.
Yeah, I know. I know him very well. Yeah.
Okay. So
yeah.
Kareem Rashid or Karim, as
Karim,
people tell you. You know, I just read his name.
Yeah.
And I was like, he was like one of the many industrial designers that was kind of profiled in this Wired magazine. And something clicked in my head at that point. It was like, well, if Kareem can do it, Ahmed can do it. and it was just like, I got off the plane and I had...
So
I told my parents I'm going to go to art school.
So that was the epiphany.
Yeah,
was the point where you decided, well, okay, this is that was like the revelation from the skies.
It really was. It was all these things
in the sky
connected.
Actually.
Yeah, in the sky. I was in the sky. This was it was while I was in my flight. I landed and I was like, I'm going to go to art school.
You.
And I'm going to go in a different direction.
That's good. Okay. And then how did you proceed?
I had to convince my dad.
Okay.
I built a binder with like salary reports and like my case, you know, and pitched it to him.
Mm-hmm.
I had a bit of help because my grandfather was a creative person.
Okay.
So there's some family kind of history there.
Always helps if there's something in the family. Yeah.
There's something in the family. Yeah. Mm-hmm. He wrote the national anthem of Pakistan. His name
really?
Is Hafiz Jalandhari. This is my grandfather.
Oh, wow.
So there's some precedent there that I was able to like ride on the coattails of and say like,
wow.
Hey, remember, like we've done this before, guys. Don't forget. But I'm going to do some creative thing. And if you read his histories, like we have a book that one of his wives wrote, which is really interesting. But like he went through a lot of journeys to become who he was too.
Mm-hmm.
So there was some family precedent. But yeah, I mean, my parents were just like a little bit taken back, but they're... they were like, well, clearly you're not happy doing what you're doing. You're not very good at what you're doing. Your grades aren't good. And
what choice do you have?
Huh? Well, they're like, what choice do we have? Why don't you do this design thing? And then when it doesn't work out, do an MBA.
Yeah. Standard thing.
We forgot the MBA, like doctori karein, engineering karein, MBA.
I told my father, also similar thing, I want to go to NCA. He said, you know, naukri nahi karni.
Yeah.
And then he pushed me towards computer science, you know, so I think it's the same story.
It's like, naukri nahi karni. I think there was a real concern. I think the concern was like, okay, fine, precedent and everything, but are you going to be able to make a living, and what's going to happen? I think I got really lucky. I mean, I did this because I couldn't do anything else. And I think the thing that happened with me was just like that user experience and, you know, actually, I studied industrial design.
Yeah.
So I went there. I studied industrial design. I met Kareem Rashid like a year later because he came to visit our school. Right, it was really surreal experience of reading with this person.
Study?
Savannah College of Art and Design.
Okay, and that's in...
In the U.S.
Yes.
What state?
It's in Georgia, but it's the biggest art school.
Exactly.
In the U.S.
Savannah.
And that's where I met John.
Yeah.
Because I remember telling my... they assign you sort of a mentor, and I remember telling him, you know, I did this computer engineering thing, and I'm doing industrial design. I wish there was a way to combine these two in some way. I don't know what to call it. He's like, don't worry, we're about to hire this guy. His name is John Colco. I think he's going to teach you this interaction design thing. You should study it. I think that's going to be your thing. I'm like, okay, I'll give it a shot. And so I've just been really lucky. I mean, I was able to take his first class. I'm really bad with the years. I'm not sure. I think it was like 2001, 2002. Okay. It's probably wrong.
Yeah.
But it was like, you know, it was like, it was at a time when it was just, it was something that at SCAD was new.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the first, the interaction design program was a minor within the industrial design program.
Okay.
Which is really strange. Now I realize.
Mm-hmm.
But I just thought that was normal, right?
Yeah, and that's like how things actually evolve as well. You have
a
new program kind of evolving within
branching
a
out
more established program.
And
the whole field of HCI grew like this, you know, coming out from cognitive science, coming out from ethnography, anthropology, sociology, you know, and then computer science, and then, you know, you got HCI, and then what is HCI? You start defining and thinking about it, then, you know, you have to go back to all these fields.
It really is, and I think there's a whole crew of people that I love it when they give their presentations, and they always have this moment. Like, and this is when I just started telling everyone I was an interaction designer. Right? Like, this is just when I started telling everyone I was a UX person, like, because they're just like, look, I just, you know, didn't exist, so I just like started telling everyone, and then I followed back. So I think the same thing happened to me. I was a immigrant kid in the States, and I was trying to get jobs in industrial design while industrial design was shrinking, and I had a minor in interaction design, luckily taught by one of the leading people in interaction design.
Yeah.
We didn't know at the time, we just thought he was like our professor. And then I was able to sort of, you know, I picked that because it was like an easier career to kind of get into. But I'm glad I did, because if I look at sort of a lot of my industrial design peers, like, they got pushed into like sort of narrower and narrower fields, user experience and HCI and interaction design just got bigger and bigger.
Yeah.
And so, you know, just a little end to the story with my parents is I went back to my dad. I'm like, okay, well, I'm ready to do my MBA now. He's like, no, you don't need to. I just told you that because, you know, I thought you'd be jobless. And I was like, no, I found an MBA in design strategy. And so actually I'm doing a design MBA. And he was very confused by that. He's like,
okay, strategy, design, and what's the commonality between the two? Yeah. It doesn't make sense. You are listening to the Design Better podcast.
So one of the things I also wanted to ask, you know, that, and that's, you know, a complete switch from what we have been thinking and talking about. Do you follow these design trends? You know, there is a big discussion in the industry that this is a new emerging trend and this is an emerging trend, whether it comes to product design, digital design, interface design, interaction design, different guidelines. You know, do you have any opinion about it? Do you follow these guidelines? You know, material design, human factors interface guideline. Apple had a switch from, you know, iOS version 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. Mm-hmm. How do you look at it, you know, when it comes to interaction design and product design?
I absolutely don't follow these trends. I think
you go with maybe, your gut.
Well, I know. I mean, we live those trends, right? Yeah, like, I mean, exactly. I think within the consulting world, you see those trends because people come to you and they're like, "I want to be the next Apple."
Yeah.
And then you try to dissect that. And, yeah. And we got that a lot at Frog because of our history with,
yeah.
you know.
Yeah, certainly.
The thing that I would say is, like, I think that if someone thinks that design is about, you know, trends,
yeah.
they're missing the idea that it's really about problem solving.
Yeah, right? Certainly.
But I think what I would say in addition to that is maybe there's sort of a added element of, like, problem solving within cultural context. And I think instead of design trends, maybe the things that we follow are bigger cultural trends. There's a trend towards, for example, being a company that maybe is more ethical, and people demanding that of companies that didn't exist maybe 3 years ago or 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. That is a trend that's much more interesting to me than a design trend.
And so, for example, one of the recent talks given by Apple's CEO in Europe mm-hmm. was spot on that, you know, that we want to be the next biggest ethical company and we want to respect your data and your privacy and, you know, and he got a standing
That's clause. Interesting because some management experts like Peter Drucker used to talk about the concept of ethical companies and doing things for the benefit of society back in, I don't know, 70s, 80s. And now companies are finally coming back to that thing.
Well, I mean, people are learning that, you know, the stuff that they thought was free is not free. And people are paying for it in other ways and they're just becoming more aware. I think it's sort of an example of, like, you know, the cultural trends actually matter much more to day-to-day design than design trends.
Yeah.
And I think other cultural trends, like, or maybe other technological trends is another example. Like, what's going to happen with AI is really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I think another trend that I'm really following is how does the gig economy change the nature of the way that people work and the way that the shape of a career has changed? So my dad's career was all, like, one company, maybe 80% of his life, you know? You would change jobs like every 10 years.
Yeah.
I think my generation, you change jobs every 3-4 years. I think the next generation is going to be all about having 3 or 4 jobs at the same time.
Same time.
And that's just going to be a career.
How many jobs do you have, Suleiman?
One. Very heavy.
So you're still in our generation.
Exactly.
You're part of the older generation.
Yeah. Certainly. You know, so Not that bad.
Yeah, but just the thought of having 3 jobs at one time, it just blows my mind. I don't know how to manage that. But I think that's something that we need to prepare for.
But you mentioned one thing very good. We had a talk, somebody from Google yesterday at LUMS, and he also talked about the technological trends and the way they derive also the decision making at the business end. So what do you think, you know, how these technological trends design derive the design trends, you know, how do they influence design? You know, so as a designer, how do you look at these trends and then try to sort of do something about it?
So I think as a designer, what you're trying to do is you're trying to put a product or service into the world that connects to people in a way that feels really relevant, right? And the relevancy comes from, you know, could be things like simplicity or, you know, all these, like,
efficiency or effectiveness,
all these things that we're used to thinking about. But I think one of the things that we're often thinking about is how does relevancy really kind of, like, affect the hearts of people? And they think about this thing and they're like, this product is something I'm really excited about. There's a reason that I really care about this, and sort of the intangibles of it, something that is hard to measure. And I think for that, you really need to kind of capture the cultural zeitgeist of what's happening and bring something in at the right time, at the right moment, that people look back and say, I remember having that thing, and that was really great. I remember depending on that thing, and that was really great. I remember when I got that let me sort of open up this whole other world that I didn't know. You know, when I got that object, I knew that people knew that I was a professional. You know, like, those are the types of things that, like, really change, the way that I think high level designers think about design versus like, sort of, hey, I read this book and I'm following this process.
Yeah.
You know, I think when you start playing the game at a higher level, you really are kind of, like, thinking about what are those core values that people have and how do you build something that kind of appreciates those core values.
And that, I think, also defines the way you work and the aspects of your job, you know, because this whole thing that who you are, what do you do, and who are you aiming at would redefine your job as you grow into the company or into the organization.
It does. Sometimes it just gets you in trouble because then you have a job that, you know, your title doesn't make sense. So I don't know. I don't know.
When it comes to design, I don't think any design title makes sense.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
How do you define strategist or
what is a design strategist?
Yeah.
We could have.
I don't know. I really don't have the answer.
Yeah. It's just one of those things, you know. But let's not get into that.
Yeah. The field itself has been renamed. You can tell a field that's been renamed as many times as ours has in the past like 10 years has a
reason for this
job definition issue. and I think it's, I don't know, maybe because it's still new and it's still
and that's why it's almost, I think it's very difficult to design these job descriptions. You know, you have this title and then this person is supposed to do A, B, C, D, E, F, G, and
I think hiring is tough. Yeah,
you know?
Describing the job definition is relatively easy. I think the titles are usually more difficult, you know.
Yeah, but I think that the other way also, you know, so how would you sync that description with the title?
We need another podcast
for that.
it's the bait of my ancestors.
Exactly.
It's definitely part of the job.
So tell me from your experience, tell me about the dynamic between engineering and design teams.
Mm-hmm.
How does that go in your experience, and what are the challenges, what are the things that work well, and how do you overcome those challenges?
Yeah, so, you know, one of the really interesting things is I've always had, maybe it's because I was trying to be a computer engineer at the beginning, or maybe I come from an engineering family, my dad's an engineer, that I always had like sort of an empathy for engineering, and so for me, I've always saw them as partners to work with. Career-wise, I've also been really lucky where both at Frog and at Logitech, we have this role called a design technologist. That's sort of like a person that kind of goes between a designer and an engineer and is able to sort of build magical prototypes and and make things look amazing. And also, this is the thing that, you know, people don't realize about design technologists. Part of their job is also to translate what engineering is saying to design and what design is saying to engineering.
Vice versa.
Mm-hmm. So I think that's sort of the critical thing. The last thing I'll sort of say is that it's a role of a designer to bridge, or I've seen it's a role of designers to bridge to engineering and bridge to business in many ways. And so they're really trying to play a way to kind of connect all these different paths together.
So you think that that's the role that design should play or is playing? Like, I'm not talking about Logitech, but the wider world.
That's the role that design has played a lot. Because I think that people get stuck into like, this is how we do things. Or I don't know why my engineers can't build this anymore, you know, or why can't I push them this way? Or the engineers are like, the business people aren't really understanding the constraints of what it takes to really build something.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it ends up being in that the designers are sort of in the middle talking to both ends and trying to create that bridge.
Yeah. So we hear all these stories, you know, about well-known companies. For example, Apple. Joni Ive was working at Apple before Steve Jobs came back, you know, before his comeback, you know, era, and he was stuck in some basement and, you know, nobody really cared what
exactly
he was doing. And then Steve Jobs comes in and becomes his kind of patron, so to speak. And that's when design is elevated and becomes this big thing and then becomes the driving force behind their kind of innovation and everything. So how do you think that's working in other companies? Is because in the case of Apple, it clearly seems that the business leader, okay, the leader of the company understood design, elevated it, gave it, you know, empowered it, and then that led to a completely
paradigm shift.
Yeah. You know? So
or if you agree with this,
So do you think this is true for all companies if they want to become successful? And for a design culture to thrive, then who needs to take hold of the reins? Is it business people and kind of sponsor designers,
Okay.
How does it work in Silicon Valley?
I wish that's I could
tell. It's an engine with a bigger question that I was thinking. So a similar thing happened at Logitech too, right? Like 5 years ago, our CEO, Bracken, took over and I think focused on design and elevated it. I think that I'll do two parts. I don't know the Silicon Valley one yet, but I'll think about it in the back of my brain.
That was just throw you off. Yeah.
Also, I'll try. I'll give it a shot.
Sure.
But I would say that it's really, really critical to elevate or highlight or give permission for things to happen. It sounds like a very subtle thing, right? Like, why do you need to give anyone permission? You're all here. Do your work. Get it done. Permissioning is actually a huge part of my job, and I think other design leaders' job, is to say, you have permission to think about this. Mm-hmm. You have permission to have a voice. You have permission to care about this, and we're going to protect you from the time to do that. We're going to elevate your voice and say, at a high level, maybe at a board meeting, or maybe when we're talking to our customers, or maybe, you know, when we're when the CEO is on a TV show, that design is important in this thing, right? And so that elevation, all those things are signals that, like, you know, we can do things in an interesting way, and that any designer can sort of have a voice, right? Because you're amplifying that voice by doing that.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
I think the reins question is a bit tricky because it implies that any one person is in control. I've been, I've seen a lot of insights of a lot of companies. No one's in control.
Right? No. And you mentioned that also in the talk.
Yeah,
I did. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So, for the podcast listeners, there was a mysterious talk as well. But yeah.
For those listening out there, we just, you know, Ahmed gave us a talk, you know.
On the secret ideas, secret life of ideas.
The secret life of ideas.
Yeah. I missed the title.
Yeah, it was a very good title and a very good talk. Yeah.
You are listening to the Design Better podcast. So...
So Silicon Valley, you know, hidden answer.
Oh yeah, so I think the Silicon, what's happening in Silicon Valley with regards to design.
Yeah,
I think that a lot of people. This might be a rant. I apologize. I think
we like rants.
Okay, so I think design became popular.
Yeah,
we won. Mm-hmm. We got a seat at the table.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Congratulations, guys. Yeah. We're all here.
Now start delivering.
What are we going to do? Right? Like, people are...
It's a good problem to have.
It's a good problem to have unless you have a seat at the table and you have nothing to say.
Say.
Yeah.
And then it's a bad problem to have because you're like, maybe I should have just been sitting down at one level below.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think one of the things is if you have a seat at the table, you need to figure out what you're going to do at that level, at that C-suite, right? And so I think that's what's happening. And I think... that there are things where people have been given certain confidences with like how they engage with design that are a little bit confusing, right? I think there's a real difference between design thinking and design doing and the balance between that. And
the craft and the thinking part of it.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And a lot of what I'm trying to do is build craft into the strategy team.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that... you know, it was very useful as a term, design thinking, and it still is. But my most recent way of engaging with it is it's really design 101.
Yeah.
And everyone's welcome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Everyone's welcome. Come to design 101.
Yeah.
But if someone is invested in like 10 years of craft. And they're at design, you know, 702.
Yeah.
And I've lost all my...
643.
Or end of, like, curriculum stuff, right? But they're like, they have a PhD in design.
Yeah.
And you're at design 101. You need to acknowledge that, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that is where it's a bit confusing, where people are like, well, I took this design thing.
Thinking, 5-day course. And
I did a bootcamp. But I don't do design, and I don't want to think about how to engage with designers. I just want to skip over all that. And I think that part's a bit tricky. And that's also happening in Silicon Valley. So people have a seat at the table. Other people are sort of sitting in the design seats, right? Yeah. And there's all this stuff being shuffled around. And then you have sort of the big companies that have been around for a while. And then you have sort of like all the startup stuff, which is, you know, everyone doing a bit of everything.
Yeah.
And I think I don't know too much about the startup stuff, but generally my feeling around startups is that they are great for what they're doing, but when you take startup culture and you try to put it into a big company and just say like, well, that's what we did in a startup, it doesn't always work that well, and it needs to evolve itself a little bit.
I just want to... So I think it's all about building a design culture and not necessarily design taking over. And, you know, for that to happen...
That's a good point,
For that to happen, everyone has to have a design mindset. The design thinking mindset, but not necessarily
you
doing
have to be
design.
Design doer.
I think that's really important, because, you know, designers will always be... a small segment of the population in relation to other people in a company, for them to flourish and do the job well, they need to have that kind of supporting culture.
They need, supporting culture.
Supporting culture. Structures, empowerment. And I think it all starts with the top dog, that person needs to really give signals, like you mentioned. That this is the direction that we want to go in.
In space. Sometimes it's just like fighting for space. Like, hey, this whole side of this office is just going to be for pinning stuff up. Some people are like complaining. They're like, why'd you give the best walls and all this space to like just like putting up design work? What's happening here? And they're just going to talk about it. And you're like, that's the culture of critique that's really absolutely necessary for us to flourish, grow, and evolve a design team that is effective.
Yeah, so physical spaces are really essential for, building a culture, enabling a culture. You know, so take for example, the place that we're in right now. We're in this space, which is enabling us to have this conversation.
And it's not easy, you've been doing that also at different places. And you've been very successful in doing that. I had a question about design and marketing. It's always, especially when you talked about the design 101, and very often people who have been have studied marketing and who've been doing marketing, they think that after doing design 101, their methodology and their thinking is in a position that, they can do design, or they can actually start making decisions as designers would decide. Mm-hmm. Have you seen this tension in different companies, the design versus marketing?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, if you have a, I think that part of that seat of the table thing, right, is like, either you're replacing someone's seat at the table and marketing is looking at like, hey, you replaced my seat. Or you're sharing, you're another person who's there, and marketing might be like, well, this was where I used to be. So I feel like within business at large, like as design gets a seat at the table, and it definitely has that now, it needs to find a relationship with marketing that makes sense. And I think part of it is just really being able to set expectations on who is responsible for what. And where we share some language, maybe separating it. I think it does get down to some linguistical stuff where it's like, yeah, we all talked about this and I thought we were in the same page. And we're not.
What user research is and what marketing research is, they're the same thing, but they're not, for example.
They're not, or what are they for, or when do you do them? And I feel like that kind of stuff we see quite often. And I think just separating them out a little bit and finding out how that makes sense is going to be critical. But it's the nature of anything, right? If you have power, other people will be like, well, that power came from somewhere. And maybe if you don't have that power, we could have that power. And so I think it's just the nature of, again, design, having a seat at the table, getting more influential. And I think that marketing has been that influence in the past. And what does it mean to really define what a product is? Like, if we get down to the nitty gritty, is it who defines what the product is?
Absolutely.
Is it the people that are like, well, I'm going to sell this product, so I better be the one to do it? Or the people that are sort of saying like, hey, I'm building the product, so I need to define the values that go into it, right? And I'm getting into the details of the design, physical and digital of it. And again, like most things, the answer is like a complex web.
Complex web.
Because you need to be able to do both things, right?
Yeah.
you need to be able to build the product and you need to build sell it.
Sell it.
You are listening to the Design Better podcast.
My top three books on design would be Being Digital by Nicholas Negroponte.
Excellent.
What else? Understanding Comics by Scott McCloud.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely wonderful.
Mm-hmm. And
something that really inspired you or made an impact.
Yeah. Maybe the classical one, 70s, 60s, 50s.
Now you're making him biased.
I'm pushing him back, you know.
Well, no, I was actually thinking of trying to pick a more recent one. Okay. I guess those two were pretty recent, too. I think for
That's the recency effect.
Yeah, it's my recency effect. Another really great book is Robert McKim's Experiences in Visual Thinking, I think it's called. Mm-hmm. It's okay. Really good. He was a professor at Stanford, and he was the guy that really was the thing behind the joint program that they created there, and in many ways sparked this idea that engineering and design could exist together, okay. Right? Yeah. So I would say, I think it's called Experiences in Visual Thinking, okay. But by Robert McKim.
Robert McKim.
So those would be my three most inspiring.
Okay, so for all our listeners out there, do check these books out.
Certainly, yeah.
And
the last one isn't available, it's out of print, but yes, it's from the 70s. So.
Right, okay.
The old one, yeah.
So, since you're talking about old books, then anyone who wants the old book can contact Suleiman.
Suleiman, I do have some copies. But Understanding Comics was a wonderful book. Yeah,
It was
one of the first books I also read. It was given to me as a course book.
Yes.
For me
as well.
Yeah.
And it's such a great book in communication and everything else. I got to meet Scott McCloud.
Really?
Yeah, I really did.
He also used to give workshops, but once he also came to Netherlands, I remember, but I couldn't take a workshop. You know.
I think it's when he'd written his second book.
Second book. And it's a guidebook also that you can follow to, you know, build your own comics. And,
it was a little bit more comic focused.
Comic focus,
so is that all about using the comic technique to
The first book is all about 2D design. Yeah. So I was given that book as a 2D design book. Two-dimensional.
Two-dimensional.
And I think it really is a really great two-dimensional design book. Nothing, you don't need to have any interest in comics to read Understanding Comics. The second one is a little bit more. People were like, why did you write this book? That's so generic, but amazing. Right?
Amazing.
And then he wrote one that was a bit more about comics.
Comics, yeah.
I met him when he came to talk at eBay when I used to work there. And I snuck my way into a lunch with him. And then I told him that I was like a fan. And then he like quipped, like he was like, what would my fans be called? Would they be called Cloudheads? And then he laughed. And that all stuck in my head. Let me draw them. Yeah, he was a hilarious guy. Wonderful and so giving.
Yeah.
A true educator.
True educator, right. Certainly. The book tells it, you know, the book tells it.
So I used the comic strip technique for one of my projects.
Yeah.
To storyboard like back in the days.
Yeah.
And it was super fun to do.
Yeah,
it's a fundamental part of what our team does is like storyboarding.
Right, I think that's something that
it is actually
all designers should take up. You know,
this whole sense of understanding time and space. You know.
Yeah. And, so what brings you to Pakistan?
I'm here in Pakistan visiting family. You know,
do you come here often?
I try to come here. I've been trying to come here every year, but I tend to come here every year or every other year. I think from this year I'm going to do every other year and get my parents to come every year.
Mm-hmm. Perfect.
Sorry, every alternate year. Yeah.
So we would give him another reason to come here every year. You know, podcast, a good talk, loans, nice society, you know, design better.
Yeah.
What do you think about design, the design landscape in Pakistan? Like, I'm talking like on a very high level.
Yeah. Great question. I actually have some awareness of that now because of the work I did with Telenor.
Yeah.
Because some of the friends I've had who've sort of moved here, some people that have started their own, you know, studios and chocolate samosa shops. There's some interesting people. And I think what's really amazing about the design landscape in Pakistan is that I think that people are incredibly driven. And they're driven to, like, both invest in Pakistan or invest in themselves, but like they're also just driven to find a way no matter what. Mm. And there's this absolute grit.
Yeah.
And I think that's along with sketching and telling stories about people, grit is a great quality in a designer.
Yeah,
certainly. Desperate times call for desperate measures.
desperate times build desperate people. I don't know. I think
they're so dedicated.
I think they build people that have grit. Yeah. And I think there will always be within the design community or the arts community as a whole a secret society of handshakes and people that understand and support each other. And that combination of grit and support is really phenomenal. And and I think I've seen, when I graduated and I came to Pakistan and I was like, hey, I did this thing, you know, people were like, well, so you paint boxes? I don't understand what you're saying. You know, literally people would not understand what I was saying.
Yeah.
So it hasn't changed because I kept evolving my job. But I think if I said I was an interaction designer, user experience person, people absolutely understood what I was saying, right?
Yeah. So that's one of the problems in Pakistan, that even now people confuse designers with artists.
Yeah.
You know,
with fashion designers.
Fashion designers, maybe.
Artists, you know, like... You know,
abstraction, you know.
Yeah, so that is a problem, but I think things are getting better.
Getting better.
And coming back to your point that you mentioned about the grit thing, what I find is that not just in Pakistan but across the globe, the people who come into the field of design, especially user experience design and interaction design or service design, they are really, really driven and focused and passionate about, and they go out of their way to do this kind of work, more so than other professionals, and that's what I feel.
Yeah, because you have to fight to get, you have to build
There's no straight path to get there. It's not easy.
Yeah, I think there's that. I'll add a sort of another angle to this as well, which I think is that when people fight for something, right, and they kind of find a way to that career or that vocation or that country, you know, they're bringing something really unique because they had to come from like different directions. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that I've tried to do is really kind of look at designing with diversity and really bringing people of different cultures. Mm-hmm. And through that, I've also seen a lot of Pakistanis and South Asians and actually from all different places. Yeah. But I found that, like, again, it comes back to permissioning. It's like they feel like they feel that they have to out-Swiss the Swiss. They feel like they have to, you know, out-design, you know, any sort of traditional, historical way of designing. But what I'm looking for is people that are actually bringing more of themselves to the table, that are sharing more of that kind of cultural element. You know, and even in little moments, like I feel like I'm starting to see in Pakistan that confidence being built up now, where people are saying, this is uniquely Pakistani, and this is what makes us, and this is why this design is as colored, as patterned, as structured, as loud, or as whatever as we need to be. Mm-hmm. And that, to me, is like the most exciting thing in bringing, you know, the voices of design from Pakistan together.
Great. I think that's a perfect place to end this whole discussion.
Absolutely.
And I think this could be an entirely separate episode.
for the next year when you come here.
Sure.
Decolonizing design, indigenous design, cultural diversity,
localization and hyper-localization.
Localization. So it's a coincidence that we're recording this podcast on a mic that has been bought by your company.
we
Logitech. Tell us about that.
Briefly. So Blue is part of Logitech now. You think you're recording a podcast, but I'm just doing a user study on you guys, and now I know all the.
Now you have to pay us actually for this, you know.
How much is the hour worth for an hour?
Well, your subjects, you know.
So exactly, yeah. You know. So pay us. How many dollars, you know?
I can give you a gift card.
Maybe we can buy a new mouse or maybe the pointer.
Get a mouse gift card.
Perfect.
Yeah. And just for the folks out there who are curious, we're recording this on a mic called the Yeti Caster.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
It sounds too grand, you know.
it's a significant object.
Yeah. It's visible. It's loud enough, you know.
And if anyone's interested in knowing more about it, then we'll share some stuff on Twitter and Instagram, and so you can see the snaps and see what it's like.
And we let you go for your shawarma.
I think we have to go now because Ahmed has to be somewhere. So, Ahmed, thank you very, very much. Cinema and myself are really, really happy to have you here on the show, and good luck with your endeavors. Logitech, and hope to see you soon.
All right. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I love this.
This is Imran Hussain. Thank you for listening to today's episode of the Design Vertic podcast. To hear more of our podcasts, head to our website at anchor.fm/designvertic. You can also download and hear our podcast using your favorite podcast app, such as Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and more. You can also find us on Twitter at DesignVertic and on Instagram at DesignVertic. That's DesignBaitak, DesignVertic. Today's podcast was produced by Timbuktu Productions on behalf of Design Vertic. Design Vertic is a community initiative to promote design, experience, and usability in Pakistan. Professor Suleimansa, na hawa hai na pani kuch peene ko hai.
Mumpli hai mumpli, mere bhai, jaan banaye.
Kamal hai.
1, 2, 3.
Koi latifa
sunaye. Yeah, I want to talk about snacks. Mumpli, actually, give me some mumpli.
Sure.
What's that snack which is like when they cook the popcorn kernels in the sand?
वो चने जो होते हैं
पॉपकॉर्न भुने हुए चने
भुने हुए
चने
हाँ मकई जो होती है
मकई
का ही है एग्जैक्टली
अब मकई ठंड में मिल जाए तो
ठंड में मिल जाए
तो फिर तो सबसे बेस्ट चीज़ है
बंदोबस्त करवाते हैं जी
That's a funny story
wasn't that funny at all it was like the search for mckay
the search for mckay
the quest for mckay yeah
the quest for mckay is deep you don't never know where these mckay people are Could be on any street at any time.
Anytime.
They're never.
I'm going to hand this over to you.
Yeah. They're never where you want them to be. But you
find them. Monkey nuts.
They call these monkey nuts.
Yeah, you didn't know that.
Why? Aren't all nuts monkey nuts?
I don't know.
Not all. I don't think so. Yeah. So we'll not take a lot of time. So let's spend 5 more minutes, maybe.
Yeah.
Let me see.
Sure. No problem. It's all informal.
Sorry, I'm seeing what the family situation is. Yeah, it's okay. I mean, we can do like 5, 10, 15 minutes.
Great.
Yeah. Maybe not more than 15.
Okay, that's good.
Yeah.
Okay. Would love to.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm a fan of shawarma.
Shawarma. Okay.
That could be a whole podcast.
On that. Okay. Different types.
Yeah.